Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to IDVAC Blog Talk Radio, brought to you by the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community, in collaboration with the Women of Color Network and the African American Domestic Peace Project. IDVAC Blog Talk Radio is made possible by a grant from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Administration for Children and Families, Family and Youth Services Bureau, and Family Violence Prevention and Services Program. Now, points of view expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the official positions or policies of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. IDVAC Blog Talk Radio brings you rich conversations and education on issues surrounding domestic violence in African American and African communities.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to the Women of Color Network, Inc. radio show hour, where we will discuss specific topics related to gender-based violence and its impact on the African-American community. The Women of Color Network, Inc. works to end violence against all women by centralizing the voices and leadership of women of color in their communities. If you are in immediate danger or feel unsafe in your homes or relationships, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233, and that's 1-800-799-SAFE. Now on to tonight's show.
Hello, and welcome to the Women of Color Network Incorporated Monthly Radio Blog Hour. This is where we bring you a range of topics addressing domestic violence in the African-American community as a national network of women of color. We use our collective voices to advocate for and educate communities about women who experience violence and hold violence abusers accountable. We use our radio blog show as a means to engage our guests and communities on important issues that all of us really should be talking about and taking actions on wherever we are and wherever we can. My name is Samaya Fire, and I'm one of the hosts tonight. Well, I'm the only host for tonight. My sidekick, who is usually Miss Alice Lynch, is not going to be with us tonight, so I'll be your host tonight with our guests. I'm the Leadership Program Director at the Women of Color Network. And in addition to other roles, I am a national trainer on a variety of topics, as well as a longtime advocate for women, children, and families who experience domestic and sexual violence, an independent consultant, and an organizer on social justice issues. So tonight we have two guests, and I'm going to introduce those guests to you in just a little bit. But before we do that, we're going to hear from Tanya Lovelace Davis on our commentary for tonight on tonight's topic on the Bresha Meadows case. Tanya, are you there?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Samaya. Again, I'm Tanya Lovelace Davis. I'm the CEO for Women of Color Network, Inc., and pleased to be with you and holding this show this evening. Bresha Meadows was 14 years old when she allegedly shot her father in the head while he slept on July 28, 2016, after years of being exposed to his physical and psychological abuse of her mother and experiencing threats and verbal abuse alongside her siblings. Bresha, now 15, is still being held in juvenile hall on charges of aggravated murder and is awaiting the decision on whether she will be tried as an adult or juvenile. Like Marissa Alexander, who is currently finishing out house arrest after being jailed for a mandatory sentence of 20 years with a plea bargain of 3 years during an act of self-defense after she fired off warning shots to stave off attacks by her abuser, there is national awareness and concern for the overreaction, overcriminalization, and overincarceration of Black women and girls by systems. Historian LaShawn Harris of Michigan State University studied the case of Virginia Christian, who in 1912 was the first woman, who was in actuality a 17-year-old Black girl who was executed by electric chair after she killed the matriarch of a family, of a white family she worked for, during a dispute about missing jewelry that turned physical. Virginia confessed to committing the crime in self-defense. Historian Harris states that Virginia's act of self-defense demonstrates the often perilous and impetuous means that African-American women, and in this case, African-American girls, may take to protect their bodies and their often last attempts to seek and secure long-awaited personal justice, especially when legal protection seems beyond their reach. Like in Virginia's case, there are several grassroots campaigns writing letters and circulating petitions and taking on other actions to spare the life of Breisha Meadows, who is being re-victimized as a child witness of domestic violence, survivor of child abuse, and bearer of the act of violence she undertook to protect herself, her mother, and her siblings. The trauma that is compounded for her as she remains in the system is nothing short of horrific. She has been under suicide watch at various points, and there is widespread concern for her overall safety within the juvenile system. This show tonight asks, what is justice for Breisha? How can we support Breisha as she experiences the continuum of trauma from her violent home into the juvenile court system? How will systems and organizations across the country support Breisha? And what can we all do to support Breisha? At the age of 15, Breisha faces life in prison if she is tried as an adult. During this time of post-election emotion and anger, let's not forget Breisha and direct our energies toward her case and others like it. Let's rally to support the dozens of Black women and girls who experience harsh sentences and treatment within the juvenile and criminal justice system and across all systems. Let's work together to address this jagged justice. I pass it back on to you, Samaria. Thank you.
Thank you, Tanya. Thanks for that commentary and for setting up our topic for tonight. So I want to introduce our guests tonight. We have Dr. Terry Pease and we have Mariam Kaba. And so I'm going to introduce Dr. Terry Pease first. She has a lifetime of work in the field of domestic violence. And until recently, Dr. Pease was on staff of the National Center on Domestic Violence, Trauma, and Mental Health. And in her semi-retirement, she is still actively offering training and consultation on organizational capacity for domestic violence and sexual violence organizations. So as founder and convener of the African American Trauma Network, she is building a group of people, both professional and others, who want to integrate what we know on an interpersonal and psychological level about the impact of historical, post-slavery, and modern trauma in the lives of African-American people and communities. Welcome to our radio blog tonight, Dr. Terry. Are you there?
I am. Thank you very much, Samaya.
You're welcome. Glad you're here with us tonight.
Thank you so much for asking.
Tonight we have Mariam Kaba, who is a community organizer, among many other professional things tonight. And so she and I have done some work recently on the Free Marissa Now mobilization campaign, and she held the work down out in Chicago. But I'm going to ask you, Mariam, if you would tell us a little bit more about yourself and what you're doing these days. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi. Yes, I. My name is Mariam Kaba, as you said. I run an organization called Project NIA, which is an organization that focuses on ending youth incarceration. So we are an abolitionist organization. We work around issues of juvenile justice and criminalization. And along with the work that I do through Project NIA, I'm also a member of Survived and Punished, which we both are a member of, Samaya, and do a lot of work around addressing the survival needs of survivors of violence. Our focus at Survived and Punished is to address the criminalization of survivors of violence through the use that use self-defense or are just trying to survive. And so Marissa's work, the work with Marissa falls under that. as well as in part some of the work that we're doing independently around the Free Brisha campaign, which is the most recent work that I've been involved in as it relates to addressing the criminalization of survivors of violence. I lived for over 20 years in Chicago, just moved back to New York City, which is my hometown, a few months ago over the summer, and so I'm really happy to join you all today.
Yes, thank you so much. Samara, yeah, Chicago's loss and New York's gain, right? So glad that you are continuing the work that you've been doing in Chicago, though, for sure. So I think I'm going to start the our conversation tonight with you, Mariam, so that if you could update our listening community on what is going on with the Brisha Meadows case. Tanya Lared, our commentary to say a little bit about what, you know, how that has come about. But if you could kind of give us a little bit more details from your experience in doing organizing around this case to support Brisha. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, of course. So Tanya did a really good job laying out the facts of what happened. Brisha did end up killing her father. She was 14. She was arrested at the end of July 28th for that action. I think what hasn't yet really been discussed that I would love to put on the table is that Brisha spent her entire life living and witnessing the violence, extreme violence that her father wielded against her mother and anybody else who got in his way. There are lots of examples of orders of protection that the mother took, attempts that the mother made to leave, attempts that Brisha made herself to run away to safety, only to be returned time and again back to her father, the police interviewing her in front of her father. You know, nobody's going to say what is happening to them when that is the case. As we know, it's bad practice. She had an aunt who tried to keep her safe, and the father called the police and accused the aunt of kidnapping Brisha. So she was really at her wit's end when she ended up killing her father. Just basically, he had been threatening to kill the whole family for a long time. And so she decided to take matters into her own hands to protect herself and her mother. So you can imagine the trauma that she was experiencing through her entire life, all those 14 years that led her to that moment. Her trauma has been compounded by putting her in juvenile jail in Warren, Ohio, at the Trumbull County Juvenile Detention Center. She is in a position now where the trauma of her life has been just magnified by the trauma of incarceration. We know through empirical research that incarceration only makes young people worse. It actually makes everybody worse, but it's particularly deleterious to the mental and physical health of young people. Brisha, while she's been incarcerated, has been on suicide watch several times. And when you're in suicide watch, they often put you in solitary confinement, which only aggravates whatever mental health issues you are already dealing with, causes new mental health issues. So all of this is happening. And again, her being incarcerated since late July with no ability to be able to go home to heal with her family is unconscionable. And we know through research that if the longer you end up spending in jail, pretrial detention, the more likely you are of getting convicted. So what we've been trying to do through the Free Brisha campaign has been to raise awareness of her case through social media and traditional media. It's been to organize around the country days of action so that people could take action around her case and raise up her name and also put pressure on the prosecutors to actually drop the charges against her and release her. We have been supporting the family in many different ways. We're right now in the process of running a fundraiser specifically for Brisha's mother and siblings to help them stay on their feet. Her mother lost her part-time job recently. The instability of that is not helpful to making a case that Bree should be released back to her family. So we've raised, as of now, over $6,000 for the family in just a couple of days to allow them to be able to pay their rent, their utilities, and things like that. And we're also trying to basically express to people the importance of making sure that children are not locked up, that children have alternatives to incarceration that are better for them, that will allow them to heal from the traumas that they've experienced that cause them to take the actions that they do, and that particularly Black girls who are harshly treated in the system don't deserve to be treated in that way. On November 22nd, Brisha will go in for her second preliminary hearing. At that point, her lawyers are going to make a motion for her to be released on her own recognizance. The judge will make a decision at that point whether or not she can be released. At the time, also, the prosecutors are supposed to announce, I think, on the 22nd, whether they're going to charge her as an adult or keep her in juvenile court or release her altogether. We insist that she is a child. We insist that she does not deserve to be tried as an adult if she's even tried at all, and we demand her immediate release to her family so that she can heal from the trauma she's experienced over time.
Okay. Thank you, Mariam, for giving us that update. This case is really... it's a very important case for us to raise to in our communities to really provide support for her in whatever way we can. Really appreciate the work that you're doing through Love and Protect, through Survived and Punished. And so we want to talk a little bit more about this regarding the trauma that she is experiencing. I want to go to Dr. Terry P. to ask a couple of questions, too, especially about the impact, the effect that this would have on Brisha. She's a 15-year-old girl. And so my question is, how would this kind of childhood and adolescent experience impact her? What do you think in terms of a trauma? What does that impact for her at this point in her life?
There's so much to say about trauma, and I think that it's useful to understand what we mean by trauma because it's a word we throw around a lot. But to really focus on what happens when a child's entire upbringing is shaped by the threat, not only threat, but actual danger of living in this kind of really vicious domestic violence. And I don't know I didn't see it, but everything we hear tells us that what happened to Brisha was extreme. And what that means is that every impulse, every push towards normal development was diverted and reshaped and stunted by, when she was tiny, by the sense of fear. Fear was the normal environment for her, and the threat of danger was part of the normal environment at an age when children should have been, when Brisha should have been exploring and learning and making mistakes and being silly and being loved. And as your organization says, Mariam, being loved and protected, instead, she must have felt repeated and overwhelming fear and repeated and overwhelming helplessness. And that's before she could talk and before she could walk and before she really had a sense of herself in the world. So before she knew Brisha as fierce and fearless as our little girls should be, she was already taught something terrible can always happen to you. That's what trauma means. It means things that are not just sad and distressing, but things that distort and overwhelm all of the natural impulses and elements of life. So then imagine that Brisha, with that background of fear and helplessness, has to be constantly distracted as she's trying to study, as she's trying to learn, as she's trying to adjust to the demands of school and playground and socialized so that everything she knew about herself in those other environments were affected by the sense that there's always danger back at home. And then she makes it through adolescence, into early adolescence, and she was an early adolescent at 14. 14-year-olds are still really little girls, more than they are anything else. And at that point, though, developmentally, that's when everything in her says, okay, I'm not a little kid anymore. Let me try to cope. Let me try to make sense of this. Let me try to take action. And that is what we hear she did. She didn't remain just stuck in her fear and helplessness. She took action, and she took appropriate action. She asked for help. From what I read in the media and from what Miriam has told us, she asked for help in the channels that any of us would say to her, this is where you go. And what she got told was, no, not you. We can imagine her father laughing at her, taunting her, threatening her as she's asked by these official people, are you safe? And so here she is, an adolescent, at the moment when all of her energies ought to be towards growing up and coping and becoming capable of reaching out into the world. And the barrier in front of her was a barrier that there was no way for her to cross. And I can only imagine that the decision to end her father's life was a decision not to stop this man from living, but to stop the harm.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, that,
it takes my breath away.
Yeah, it does. That's the same thing with, adult women survivors, victims of domestic violence, who want the violence to stop. You know, when they're talking about why do victims stay in a relationship where there is violence, that it's the one thing that they want to stop is to stop the violence. So when you think of Risha, Dr. Terry, what do you think about her in terms of what she's experiencing physically in her physiology, the trauma in her brain? Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Absolutely, because trauma is not just in thoughts and feelings. It absolutely shapes the way the brain develops. And so a child, a young person who's constantly in fear has brain circuits that become hyper-aroused or hyper-aware so that every little fear becomes magnified and every little risk becomes it becomes hard to distinguish a small risk from a life-threatening risk, because that capacity to make those subtle judgments, which is already not fully developed in adolescence, but the capacity to make those judgments between that's just somebody making a face at you or that's somebody threatening your life, becomes really compromised. And I don't know Brescia, but I know kids, and I know that this something sometimes happens, so that her very brain is reacting as an organism that should and that naturally and automatically expects danger. That means that even if we were to wrap our arms around Brescia and get her out of that place, and even if we can do what must happen, which is to get them to drop the charges, and I don't know the legalities of this, but if we could stop this awful process that she's encountered right now, she still would need healing, and she would need healing of a long-term, gentle, protective, and very, very patient nature.
So thank you for that. So, Mariam, when I read the article, one of the first articles that came out about this case, and it mentioned about her mother referring to Risha as the hero of their family. And that struck me as so odd because, well, it's like here this little girl is in prison, in an environment where she really shouldn't be. But, her family is seeing her as a hero. It's like such, it just seems like not a hero, but in such a very sad situation. Can you talk a little bit about that from what you know in terms of your interactions or your connections to the family?
Well, I'm not directly connected to the family. Other members of the Free Brescia campaign are directly connecting with the mother and other members of the family, particularly Marcia Dinkins, who's part of the Mahoning Valley Organizing Collaborative, which is directly in Warren, Ohio. So we're working very closely with local advocates around this issue. I will say this. I really am not going to – I feel like it's hard and difficult to understand what goes on in people's families. By all accounts, from what I've heard directly from people who have been talking and door-knocking in Warren, this person, her father, had been terrorizing people for decades. The mother has been a victim of serious, extreme domestic violence for decades. I don't know how much fear that mother has been living in. I definitely know that Brescia was living in fear. I imagine that having your teeth knocked out by your husband is probably a thing that makes you feel a sense of terror of him. People who, some folks from the Mahoning Valley Organizing Collaborative were asking people in the community if they had ever noticed that this family was dealing with so much trauma and domestic violence, and everybody in the community that they knocked on the door of, that opened the door, said yes, they all knew what was going on. In fact, he would brandish his gun at other people. Usually victims of domestic violence perpetrators are often incredibly aggressive to other people too, as a way to intimidate and keep people isolated. I know something about the cycle of violence as it relates to domestic violence because I worked in domestic violence organizations for many years. You know, I can see the patterns of that. So what the mother is probably feeling is an incredible sense of guilt herself for having stayed, even though she left and came back for many reasons that we all understand, that it takes an average of 7 times often for a domestic violence survivor to make a full break from their abuser. She, you know, did her best as she saw fit. And her daughter, calling her daughter a hero is probably a sense of just wanting to extend the love that she feels for her daughter mixed with the guilt that she feels about staying. I just have a lot of compassion for that family, for everybody, the siblings and the mother. I just would very much like Brescia to be able to get out of that jail. If they are going to charge her and if they're going to take her to trial, she should be able to fight from outside that jail cell. She does not need to be locked up for them to go forward with their unfair, unjust prosecution. We have a right to defend ourselves. We really do. Even though the culture and the system says that black women in particular and black children have no right, no selves to defend, we do have a right to defend ourselves when we feel our lives are at stake. And this girl felt her life and her family's life was at stake. She did something that was incredibly, I imagine, hard for her to do. Because those of us who live in, you know, if you've ever been in a situation where you've been abused or you've been in a family where there's abuse, you find yourself still loving the people who abuse you. That's like a normal thing, you know? So even mm-hmm. though she killed her father, she most likely loved him deeply.
I get that. I really do. But before we talk more about that part of our conversation tonight, I want to remind callers that you can call in to join the conversation. Call the number 347-327-9611. We're going to take a break for a moment, but when we come back, you can definitely call that number, 347-327-9611, to join our call tonight with Dr. Terry Pease and with Mariam Kaba. So we'll be back in just a moment.
To Sister Tanya Lovelace, and the staff and advisors of the Women of Color Network. On behalf of Tony Porter, Bishop Freeze, and a call to men, all the men here want to say thank you. We want to recognize and thank you for the hard work and efforts to address and challenge the rights of women of color in the movement today. We just want to let y'all know we ain't got nothing but love for you. Nothing but love. Out to all the women of color, from a call to being dead to well-meaning brothers, cause we appreciate the hard work that you do. With all due respect, we just wanna say thank you for challenging us all to be better people. Like Dr. King said, we all created equal, staying on the front lines of the struggle, always do the rescue for women in trouble, for crimes like sexual assault and DVs, eliminating violence on women and family, addressing human trafficking and police brutality right here in the United States, and that's reality. Well done, sister, job well done, for the call to action for each one, teach one. So from a call to men and all his well-meaning brothers, sisters, we ain't got nothing but love for you.
Okay, we're back. We got the karaoke queen over here, Sister Samaya Fire, rocking it with Bishop Freeze on Ain't Got Nothing But Love For You. That's our 2010 call to action song. So, okay, anyway, we also have on the call here LaVar Morris Brent, and she's calling in and has some questions for us tonight to join this conversation. Sister LaVon, are you there?
I am here. Hello.
Hello. How are you, my dear?
I'm doing well this evening. Thank you. I'm loving the conversation.
Good. What do you have for us? I know you have a good question for us.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, I got to try to condense it all, you know. First, I'd
just
like
before,
to say,
before you do that, tell everybody who you are. I'm talking to you like you're my sister friend down the street, because you are. But, you know, tell our listening audience a little bit about yourself.
Right. Who am I today? Today I am LaVar Morris Grant, and I am an international speaker and author on violence against women. And I've been connected with WOCN, oh, my God, for at least over 10, 12 years now, in various capacities. And so, you know, I'm out here as a social justice advocate on our political issues and dealing with, you know, a lot of different things. So always putting my voice in the ring and fighting for justice, particularly for black women, unapologetically.
Absolutely. And you do that very well. So, so what is your question in the conversation tonight?
So, in the conversation and, you know, doing the work on the larger scale of the conversation and the breaches and so many like her, and she's a girl, I really would like us to talk to the audience about how, for some reason, when black girls are incarcerated or defending themselves against the violence, our mainstream, we always want to look at them, or they always want to call them women. You know, they just like with the Trayvon Martins and all those kind of cases, all of a sudden our children become men and or women instead of keeping them in the place that they are, which are children. And how can we begin to change that in our national mainstream and get our national organizations on board with, you know, co-signing and speaking out against these issues around our black girls and black women being, you know, incarcerated and then calling them different identities of being women when they're just really children, and we can get around and rally behind that fight to keep the public understand that these are children we're dealing with.
Okay, that's a really good question, a very strong question. Either one of our guests want to address that question?
Well, I'd love to address that because, Fani, as you know, that is something that I have always felt really strongly about, that I know we really cringe from the idea that the words girl and boy are applied to us as adults, because that was a way of demeaning dignified and fully mature adult people. But our boys are not young men, and our girls are not young women when they're 10, 12, 13 years old. They're kids. And we play into a narrative that says that black children's innocence is non-existent when we call them adult names, when we call them men, we call them women. So I think partly that we talk about the innocence of children, that we make sure that we always use the words girl and child and not be afraid of those words in their proper developmental context. And how we move mainstream domestic violence organizations to do right, well, that's a big question. I love the domestic violence field and have worked in it for my entire life. But I know that we have to take the stand of making sure that we hold people accountable for times that their social justice ideals and their ideals of equity don't actually get carried out in real life. And this is just one example of that. I mean, think about the difference between hero girl saves mother from life-threatening circumstance, which is really what Brisha did, and the way it gets played out in the mainstream media. If this were a story of a kid pulling their mom out of a burning car, you know, they'd be getting a medal at City Hall. I don't think Risha's impulse was any different than that. And that is the sort of grand heroic gesture that teenagers make because they're kids.
Thank you, Terry. Mariam, do you want to add to that?
No, I think I don't have anything else to add to that.
Yeah, so I think that what you're saying, Dr. Pease, definitely is right on target. You know, in terms of how our children are not allowed to just be children, and the criminalization of that action. I like how you put that, the same as rescuing a mother from a burning car. You know, that really put it into context for me, because I had raised that earlier about her being called a hero. That your explanation of that definitely puts that into context for me. I appreciate that. The other thing that, in terms of what LaVon is asking about, getting support from mainstream organizations. I want to stay there a little bit because, you know, it is so important for the power that is in the mainstream organization, the power and the privilege that is there that can help to make a difference in terms of organizing, in terms of raising awareness, in terms of giving some credibility to the organizer that is out there as a national movement. You know, I think that is so important to focus on. It was, you know, it was the same thing that was needed for the Free Marissa Now mobilization campaign as well. You know, people from various movements came together across the nation, which gave a lot of attention to that case, which I still believe to this day had a lot to do with the outcome of that case. And so, you know, here we are again now with a young black girl, 15 years old, who also needs that kind of support and focus from a mainstream movement that could help them make a difference.
So, Levon, is that where you are? What you are saying and what you are thinking in terms of what that kind of support would make a difference in this case?
Exactly.
Potentially, at least. Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. And the last thing to add to that with the mainstreams, you know, I understand that there could be some restrictions, you know, whatever those restrictions may look like, but there's other ways creatively to reach out, right? They can reach back into the Black community or those communities of community-based programs who are not restricted to, they can lend their resources to us, right? And we can get and take the lead, and they in the background with their resources to allow us to do what we need to do to mobilize and organize around our folk that are locked up, incarcerated, when we just using the same rights as everyone else to defend ourselves, right, through self-defense. So there are other ways that national organizations can be involved without being in the forefront of the involvement if that's going to create, you know, some issues. You know, just reach back into the communities and get to know those communities to help be that voice and to take the lead, you know, in that particular part of the work. So that's why I wanted to put that out also, if that'll help.
So in one of those ways that people can take action that will help to make a difference if it, you know, as much as increase in awareness about the case. I don't even have a good sense or feel of how aware are people about this. So, Mariam, if you were saying what would be some of the things that what we call mainstream organizations or just community-wide that people could do to take actions to increase awareness about this case, and also, too, well, of course, one of the things to do is to give to the fundraiser. But in addition to giving to the fundraiser, what are some other things that people can do?
There's a ton of things that people can do. People can connect in their own communities and pay attention when they notice that people are in distress, and they can figure out ways to support folks in their own neighborhoods, right around the corner, in their own homes, in their families. There's lots that people can do to raise awareness about what are the dynamics of domestic violence, what does it look like, what are the impacts, how can you intervene in a way that remains safe for you. There's a freeresha.com website where there's a list of many different things that people can take on to help support Resha. They can write letters to the prosecutors. They can send Resha letters, they can send her books, they can, you know, there's a curriculum that we have online, they can host teach-ins about Resha's case, putting it into larger historical context and then talking about what is happening to her currently in this moment. There's a million different ways that people can be involved. People can pay attention if you're on juries and you are asked to look at the cases of survivors of violence. You should take into consideration the trauma they've experienced if you are going to be sitting on those juries and passing judgment on them for actions they take for self-defense and survival. I mean, the list is really endless of ways that people can get involved, and we've been really heartened that people have really taken notice of Resha's case. You know, thousands and thousands of people have been engaged in her work and in the work to free her. We have had hundreds of people attending teach-ins all around the country the first week of October in preparation for what we thought was going to be the hearing that was postponed. You know, thousands and thousands of dollars have been raised for her legal defense, and now thousands of dollars for her family's expenses. People have been incredibly generous. We could always use more awareness to not just her case, but her family also wants people to see the cases of other young women who find themselves in the same position as Resha, other young gender nonconforming people who find themselves in the same positions as Resha. There are many Reshas in the world, many Reshas in our country. So I feel like actually very encouraged. I see a lot of openings and a lot of opportunity for people to engage and join and participate and help push this forward. It's a movement that needs to happen, not just individual campaigns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I hear you on that. That's lots of braces, lots of braces. And it's so important for us to know who they are, where they are, and to be able to support them. I know that you have to leave a little bit early on our call, and I want to be respectful of that. I heard you give out BreeshaMeadows.com.
No, just FreeBreesha. FreeBreesha.com.
Okay, FreeBreesha.com. Again, FreeBreesha.com, SurvivedAndPunished.org, and that other, would that be LoveAndProtect.org?
LoveAndProtect.org. I think it's like LoveAndProtect.org, some weird thing like that. But people could also go to Project NEA, my organization, which is Project-NEA.org as well, to follow the work that we do around youth incarceration and ending that.
Okay. Great.
Yep.
It has been such a pleasure to have you on the call with us. Do you have last words that you could give us before you get off the line?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say again, we are, you know, the elections just happened, and I think people are rightly feeling out of sorts and kind of figuring out what's next and what's happening. There's a lot of anxiety about a lot of different kinds of things. I just hope that people don't forget that we've got people behind bars, prisoners, detainees, and that we need to keep our attention and our focus on them, even as we are focusing on many other things too. I think we really, really need to be able to you know, juggle many balls at once in the air and not forget and not ignore the plight of people who are incarcerated, people who are criminalized, people who are the most marginalized within our society. So I'm really hopeful that people will continue to organize for and on behalf and with prisoners and detainees of all ages.
Thank you so much. Appreciate
you. Thank you. Bye.
Absolutely adore you. And you be safe and be well, and I look forward to doing more organizing work with you.
Thank you so much, Samaya. Take care.
Alrighty.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye-bye. So we're not ending our call. That's not the case. We're going to continue to have our conversation with Dr. Terry Keyes. And so are you still there, Dr. Terry?
I am.
Great, 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 great. So I have some more questions for you. So one of the things I want to talk about is, you know, the process that Brisha is going through and the impact of the trauma. My question is, what is it that she would potentially need when she's freed? I want to shift it to a positive note, that she would be freed. We, you know, we feel like we've won the mobilization campaign and saw Marissa free and a couple of other sisters free this past year. So want to talk about Brisha being free. What will she need to get her life back in order to be restored?
Wow, I mean, that's such a big and such an important question, because it's not just a matter of restoring, because we have to recognize that a child who's been in this situation for her entire development is not going to be able to just bounce back. We really, in our community, we really prize and value resilience and strength, and yet to minimize the need for healing and the need for reforming her identity is really important. We have to, whoever is involved in helping to give this child back the life that she deserves, or to give it to her for the first time, I hope understands that protection and safety is only the very first step. Once she is physically safe, out of incarceration, no longer under the threat of prosecution, she is going to be just at the very beginning and reconnecting to an identity that is not an identity of living in risk and not an identity of having to constantly protect herself and her family and to always be a hero. It's going to be a complicated thing. In part, it's going to be kind of scary, and I don't want to use a clinical word exactly, but almost depressing once she's safe to think, oh, and I don't know anything about how to live in a world of safety. And I think that's true for many people who come out of an incarceration where they've been absolutely on alert the whole time. So she's going to need love and comfort and safety. If I were advising people on how to help bring her back into life, it would be to make the early celebration short and welcoming and not to require of her lots and lots of public appearances or that she has to be overly ecstatic about being free, because she's going to be just, I'm extrapolating, of course, but she's just going to be in shock. And the thing that I think more than anything is clear, deep protection and gentle reconnection.
So do you, based on your background and experience, do you have a sense or do you have thoughts about what she could be experiencing, you know, right now psychologically, being away from her, not only being away from her family, but just the whole trauma of the act of that shooting? And to be isolated in the way she is.
Well, if you think about how it is to be an adolescent and how adolescents have grand ideas that they can do something big and heroic and important, and then it's a normal developmental process to kind of be brought up short and think, oh, not quite that easy. But then the adults around us should be kind of gently protecting us. For her, she took this enormous action to free her mother and get her mother safe, but the cost to her has been so enormous. I hope that her mother, in saying that she's her hero, is letting her know how much she values who she is, but also to really get that what's going on day to day in that incarceration is that all of the supports, all of the things that she knew to do are only going to give her more trouble. If fighting back kept her safe, that's going to give her more trouble in an incarceration situation. If shutting down and being quiet and meek and silent had kept her safe or tried to keep her safe when she was at home, then doing that in the context of incarceration has gotten her, it seems, onto a suicide watch. And so there's nothing that she can do. Even her accustomed adaptations aren't working. So I have to imagine that this poor child is just so overwhelmed and so lost. I don't know whether the place that she's in has some of the worst dangers that sometimes go with juvenile incarceration. My understanding is that it's not an enormous place, but it could be a very unsafe place. At its best, programs for adolescent offenders are about reshaping and redirecting their developmental impulses and urges into healthy channels and giving them the tools that they need to understand what they've done and understand how it isolates them from society and to give them a path back. So I don't know what is happening to her, but I fear the worst.
I so appreciate what you're saying, because You're doing a great job at, painting a picture for us about her experience, where she is now, which to me should move us as a movement, move us as a community to support her in the best ways that we can. You know, it's about what we have in our hands. You know, the justice we hold in our hands, what we have the capacity to do to make a difference in this situation. I think about her family, you know, and what kind of support that her family needs now and what kind of supports
that her family would need when she's released. Do you have a sense of what that would look like?
You know, I think that different people respond to different kinds of resources. I think that spiritual resources, if they are connected to a faith community, can be very helpful, but not the suggestion that any one thing, including prayer on its own, is going to be enough to restore this family. I think they need voices and places and people that listen to how they experience what's happening and take their lead in offering supports, resources, services, time, money, autonomy, and care, just care. The reason I think about the African American Trauma Network, which is something I'm hoping to really consolidate this year, is that it should be about healing ourselves and caring for each other and taking seriously that this is about suffering, that this family has suffered, and they deserve help and time and resources to heal.
I see. Well,
thank you so much for being on with us and holding this conversation. This is so important. You put a lot of things into a very clear context for us. It is time for us to end our talk tonight. And I'm wondering if you have something that you could say to us, 30 seconds. I wish it was 30 more minutes. But something that is be your last words to our listening audience tonight.
I think safety and treasuring and prioritizing our own safety, understanding that action, activism, is often the step towards safety, is really the groundwork for protecting children like Brisha and families like Brisha's. I hope I can invite people to follow the African American Trauma Network, AA Trauma Network, on Twitter, and for us to start talking to each other about our hurts and how we heal ourselves and each other.
Thank you so much. Yes, we do want to absolutely follow you on the African American Trauma Network. We will be promoting your work and inviting you back again. We are at the end of our hour, and it has been a pleasure to have you on as our guest tonight and also Mariam Kaba. So we're going to say good night, and we look forward to having more conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you, listeners, for joining the Women of Color Network Radio Show Hour. We appreciate your listening and your support of our show. If you are in immediate danger or feel unsafe in your homes or relationships, again, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233. That's 1-800-799-SAFE. We again appreciate your listening support and have a good evening.
Well, that's it for today's show. You've been listening to IDVAC Blog Talk Radio, right here every week at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. IDVAC Blog Talk Radio is brought to you by the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community, in collaboration with the Women of Color Network and the African American Domestic Peace Project. Visit us on the web at idvac.org to find out more information about our guests and presenters and to download podcasts of previous shows of IDVAC Blog Talk Radio. Until next week, be safe.